Hello and welcome to Soundcheck, a new program about issues, ideas, and people from Raven Radio, KCAW, in Sitka. You can listen to Soundcheck online at our website, kcaw.org, or download Soundcheck as a podcast from the iTunes Store. I'm your host, Robert Woolsey. Estimating wildlife populations in southeast Alaska has always been a difficult problem for biologists. The Tongass Forest both sustains and conceals large numbers of Sitka black-tailed deer. For decades, scientists have relied on fecal pellet studies to gauge populations, but deer scat is not a fingerprint. There's no way of accurately determining how many individual deer produce a given number of pellets. Until now. Todd Brinkman is a researcher with the Institute of Arctic Biology in Fairbanks. John Martin is an assistant professor of biology at the University of Alaska Southeast. I asked the two scientists to talk about how DNA is revolutionizing the study of Sitka black-tailed deer.
In other parts of Alaska, you got these aerial surveys that work really nice for moose or caribou, but of course you fly over the Tongass, you're lucky to see the forest floor, let alone a deer moving around on it. So we, and I say we as in biologists and researchers, have never had a tool to get a precise estimate of deer abundance in the Tongass until this genetic opportunity came along, this ability for us to extract DNA from fecal pellets and use that DNA to identify individual deer and be able to determine that this pellet came from a deer that's different than all the other deer in the woods.
Probably there's a popular belief that DNA is just the easiest thing in the world to extract. You know, if you find an old bone or something, you know, we'll just go get the DNA from it. But it's really, it's sometimes, you know, really quite challenging.
It's extremely labor intensive and frustrating at times. And no, you can't get good quality data or DNA from anything like bone or hair or feces is particularly challenging. If you're using blood or like muscle tissue, it's a different story. You got really high concentrations of DNA and that stuff. But with fecal pellets, scat, hair, you're working with a very degraded, low concentration of DNA, and it takes a lot of troubleshooting in the lab to get it fine-tuned.
Have there been dramatic differences between more conventional methods of assessing population numbers and the new methods? Or are you going, oh my God, we've been getting it wrong?
Before this, we never really had another method to use.
Okay.
So we can't directly compare our results very well with any other estimates of abundance on Sitka deer. So they've done pellet count surveys, as you know, for 30, 40 years. And it can give you a general idea of maybe long-term trends, but it can't give you any sort of quantitative estimate with precision. So we don't have anything directly to compare it to. But based on some of these other approaches like pellet group counts or maybe these shoreline counts or roadside surveys where they can conduct them, where they do have roads in southeast Alaska, our results were in the ballpark. So they weren't anything too crazy, I guess.
John, what does it mean for actually being out in the field? Is the application of this technique going to make a difference, do you think, for biologists in Southeast?
Yeah, I think that this technique is something that's going to be used in a variety of different formats. You know, I think that one of the things that people are looking at now is second growth forests and best ways to manage second growth forests in terms of, you know, pre-commercial thinning and creating gaps in those forests. And to have this tool available to actually go into these areas that have been disturbed and get an idea of deer abundance is something that's going to be incredibly useful for us in the future. So I think there is some challenges. It's definitely different than the approaches that have been used historically to manage deer populations and sort of forest management. But I think it's going to be something that's going to be neat.
Kind of the dumb question that comes to my mind, and part of being a reporter is you get to ask dumb questions, but in a deer pellet, there's a lot of DNA. I mean, the deer is eating stuff with DNA in it. It's got to be kind of a needle in a haystack kind of thing.
That's a really good question. So what we're actually doing when we're getting this DNA off the pellet is we're never breaking open the pellet. the DNA that we want is actually just on the outside of the pellet. So as that pellet goes through the deer's gut, these skin cells inside its gut are shed on the pellet. And then what we're actually doing is just washing off those skin cells and sampling from that. So we're never getting into like the plant DNA that maybe you're talking about on the inside of the pellet. And the other thing that's kind of working in our advantage is that sitka deer are a genetically unique species. Since they're kind of isolated to Southeast Alaska and Northern British Columbia, their genetics are, and they haven't mixed with a lot of these other species, even in the past, their DNA and the markers that we use to identify their DNA is different than all these other species. Yeah, so these little pellets that we find in the woods, they're libraries of information to me, the DNA on them. So we can identify individual deer and use that to get an abundance estimate. But what else we can do with DNA is find out how deer in this watershed, how much they're related to deer, say, in this watershed. We can get an idea how frequently these populations mix. And what we found just with our preliminary data is that these deer are pretty isolated within these watersheds, and they don't mix as much as we thought. So this can be a new tool to kind of get an idea of these subpopulations across the different islands of Southeast Alaska.
I wonder what that will mean for management ultimately, because now in in mountain goat hunting, it is kind of a watershed by watershed management situation, and I wonder if we might be moving in that direction for deer, because there are certain places like the Lindenberg Peninsula and northeastern Chichagof Island that have road access where the populations are stressed.
I think it's really important to consider accessibility in these watersheds when you're trying to manage them. I mean, I don't think that you need to worry so much about some of these remote areas that hunters can't get to. If your interest is in managing hunting opportunities, you should probably put most of your effort in the areas that are receiving most of your hunting pressure and these watersheds that people are most dependent on.
Todd's research was done on Prince of Wales Island, and I think the hunting system down there is a lot different than the hunting system that we have here on Baranof and Chichagof Island.
Because it's roaded?
Right, right. I suspect if you were to do survey data, and I know Fish and Game is actually collecting data. We've got those report cards that we submit at the end of each year that talks about what our mode of transportation was and where we were when we, harvested an animal. But I think if you did some survey data here in Sitka, you would find that very little deer harvest happens with roads. I think that the majority of, and this has been my experience, and I think Rob, you're a hunter, you could probably speak to this, but it's boat access. And there's a lot of people utilizing the shoreline, particularly during the winter months when we get heavy snows, and it's forcing those deer down into those beach line fringes. And the guys that go up into these watersheds are really hungry for not just harvesting the meat, but also for the adventure and the sport of hunting in the alpine. So I think that the hunting system here is different than what is, Todd has sort of done down on Prince of Wales Island.
Yeah, whenever I go down south, it's always interesting. My family who lives down there, they've got it dialed in where to get the best parking spot at the mall, the best, quickest way to get to the, the Old Navy store, to the movie theater.
Yeah.
And here we know exactly where you can put where you can anchor your boat, where it will fit, safely. So you can go hunt for the day and then get back to it. And most of the time it will still be floating. But every once in a while, not. This area, we are just kind of dialed in, and probably in our translator villages too. They just know places, they've just sort of got it figured out. It's totally not road dependent. So
yeah.
Prince of Wales, it didn't used to be, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I mean that's the interesting story on Prince of Wales Island. Most of the communities on there are coastal, so they probably hunted a lot like folks in Sitka did before industrial scale logging. With industrial scale logging, you have this massive road network being created that penetrated all these previously inaccessible areas. So folks hopped out of their boats and hopped into vehicles and took advantage of all this new access to these fresh clear cuts full of deer. But now, as logging has came to a crawl in those areas, you have these clear cuts growing up into that second growth stuff that not only can be not very good for deer, but it's also not very good deer hunting habitat. So you're seeing some people adapt where they're hopping back in their boats.
I want to sort of shift gears and talk about the other part of your, how forest change is affecting hunting opportunities. But first, I want to ask you about the spaghetti graph.
This was a popular graph that I created. I really tackled this hunting system story from two sides. I looked at it from the social angle and from the ecological or more biological angle. I began with the social, so I spent a lot of effort just talking to hunters. I had these very in-depth interviews with 88 hunters in 11 communities on Prince of Wales Island. And I asked them a variety of questions on their hunting patterns, on their perception of deer population trends, on what their favorite habitats are to hunt, on how they access these areas. And those were all real good questions to ask hunters. One kind of unfair question that I asked them was what the population size was on Prince of Wales Island. And as a hunter myself, it's really tough to estimate a population size over a big area. I have a pretty good idea what's going on in the area that I hunt, but I tried to push the hunters into the direction of give me their estimate of what they think the population size is on Prince Wales Island, how that's changed over the last 30 years, and how they think it'll change over the next 30 years. So on a graph, I plotted the perceptions of all 88 deer hunters. And if you look at that graph now, you could take a handful of spaghetti and throw it at it, and it would look a lot like the graph I constructed after plotting all these hunter perceptions. So they all kind of had a different idea what the population was and how it's changed through time.
What do you think the principal variables are in a hunter's perception? Is it the amount of time he or she has lived on Prince of Wales? Are you talking with people who've hunted there before all the intensive logging, or are you talking about people who are relatively recent arrivals who, you know, go hunting for them means jumping into the pickup truck and driving somewhere? Or what do you think it is?
I talked to both. I talked to people that have been there for several generations, and I've talked to relatively newcomers. On average, the folks I talked to have about 20 years of experience on the island. That was the average. But getting back to your question of what's kind of driving their perception, I did ask that question directly, and a lot of them used kind of the number of deer that they either see while they're driving the road network or out there hunting as their indicator of the overall population size. So it's the deer they actually see driving along the roads, maybe not just while hunting, while going to work or going across the island. And the reason why that may be misleading, especially as your forest changes, is because 20, 30 years ago, you'd drive down the roads and you could see the landscape around you because it was all young clear cut. Now you drive down those roads and you have this thick second growth right next to the road, and your visibility went from 100 yards to maybe 10 yards off the road. So probably overall your chances of seeing deer has declined. So I often wondered during these interviews how that has influenced people's overall perception of population change.
Are you able to draw any kind of conclusion from the spaghetti graph other than the fact that it's very unique?
It was unfair of me, as I said, to ask that sort of question. I mean, this local knowledge and sometimes traditional knowledge is, as everybody knows, a great source of knowledge for certain questions. But during that graph, you know, they would put different curves on this graph to show how it's changed. So there was incredible value in just asking them why the line went up or down. So I got a great deal of information on their perception of not just what the actual number it was, but why that number has changed through time. So it was a good exercise. Hunting systems aren't just about wildlife. A hunting system, you need to know a little bit about the hunters, the wildlife, and also the environment that the hunters and the wildlife interact in. To truly understand that system, you need to know the interaction between all those components, how it changes over time, and what's driving that change. So I felt that a more interdisciplinary, integrative approach was necessary to understand the story.
Part of me wants to say, John, that this is as revolutionary as DNA and pellets, looking at, you know, this interdisciplinary approach. I mean, I think the old school biology. I don't mean to diss any old school biologists, but wasn't it more about just counting up animals and counting up effort?
Yeah, I was really impressed with Todd's work and the approach that was taken on this project. And I think particularly for Alaska, you know, where the protein that hunters get from not just deer but caribou and moose is really important for folks. Just not just supplementing, you know, protein sources, but also from that sort of family tradition perspective. And I think that in taking all of that into account, I mean, that's really fundamentally what game management should be about, is not just looking at the biological issues, you know, forest management and deer populations, but also how that interplays with the people that depend on those resources. So I think that was a really wonderful approach. And I think that I would like to see in the future, as we start to look at, you know, goat management and bear management and all these other things, trying to take this multidimensional approach to some of these issues that are coming up in Alaska. So I think it's wonderful, you know, because a lot of the social stuff is kind of whispers in the back of the room. You know, people talk about the biology, and then you've got, you know, the people that actually depend on that resource, whether you're a commercial fisherman and talking about fish populations, or you're a hunter talking about, you know, how you need to get moose in your freezer, deer. That stuff is really not brought to the front. And I think it's really important to bring those issues to the front so people have a good understanding. And it's also, there's an educational component there. So I think there's an opportunity when Todd sits down with these folks to interview them, to also pass off some of the information and knowledge that he's gained through his research as a trained biologist. And I think that it's just this sort of reciprocal process, and it's good for the science, it's good for the managers, it's good for the people in these communities.
Anytime you involve your as many stakeholders as you can in the process, you're going to get better input, and you're also going to get better reception of your results.
Do you think that this research in any way puts hunters at odds with loggers or the timber industry?
Maybe initially, but I think that most folks in Southeast Alaska are to the point that they realize that, yeah, these second growth stands aren't very good for deer. Everybody recognizes that. Because if we want to maintain high levels of hunter opportunities and keep this as an important part of our culture and tradition around here, which I hope it does, because as you mentioned earlier, hunting is one way, one really good way for us to stay attached to our environment. We're going to have to do a good job of figuring out some innovative and creative ways to manage this second growth. And they're starting to do that. They're starting to look at some of these gap openings and try some different experiments where they can break up this homogeneous second growth and create more of a natural setting where you got some open areas, yet you got some canopy cover. So what I'd like to do next is, where they're already doing kind of this forest work, is get in there and see how deer are responding so we can come up with strategies that may not only be effective for over the long term keeping some commercial value in these stands, but also keeping a good carrying capacity of deer.
Biologists Todd Brinkman and John Martin are interested in using groundbreaking DNA studies and social research to paint a more detailed picture of the relationship between people, wildlife, and the forest. You can find links to Brinkman's research at our website, kcaw.org. Soundcheck is a new program about issues, ideas, and people from Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka. If you were expecting to hear local news at this time, you can find that broadcast online at kcaw.org. I'm Robert Woolsey. Thanks for listening in on Soundcheck.